You got your phone, Tony?
I have, yeah.
My colleagues have supplied the missing information.
We're just handing up, Mr. Chairman, the two pages for each witness summaries.
I think what we'll do is ask you to invite, I'd like you to read your summaries one after the other, and I'll work through their questions on the basis that we pose a question to one or other of you that either may ask.
No Lou, but that's okay.
No Lou.
Kleinlinger felt low.
It's low.
Oh,
right.
Good.
The commission was telling me, was tutoring me, and I was trying to get it right, so I apologise.
No trouble. Kaitohu's traditions, culture and practices are intricately linked with their ancestral lands, water, sites, wahitapu and other tauka. The RMA requires that these values are recognised and provided for as a matter of national importance under Section 16. In my evidence, I highlight the breadth of the terminology in Section 16. Ancestral lands gives rise to landscape scale considerations. It is clear that Section 6E is not just referring only to discrete sites or wahitapu, as these are also listed. Section 7 of the RMA requires particular regard to kaitiakitanga. As articulated by Edward Ellison, kaitiakitanga is not a choice, but an inherited responsibility. Kaitiakitanga is a duty of active care and responsibility with the objective of maintaining, enhancing and enhancing places of significance for the current generation and those generations that follow. Section 8 of the RMA requires the Council to take into account the principles of te tiriti or waitanga. The framework for mapping the wahi tūpuna in Chapter 39 gives effect to the objectives and policies of the partially operative regional policy statement for Otago. Policy 2.2.2 requires councils to recognise and provide for the protection of wahi tūpuna by all of the following: avoiding significant adverse effects on those values that contribute to the identified wahi tūpuna being significant, avoiding, remedying or mitigating other adverse effects on the identified wahi tūpuna, managing the identified wahi tūpuna sites in a culturally appropriate manner. The proposed Otago Regional Policy Statement also provides very clear direction for councils to include wahi tūpuna maps, values and provisions to protect these in our plans. The mapping of wahi tūpuna supports kārunaka involvement in resource management matters relating to their interests and allows them to perform their role as kaitiaki. Cultural landscapes can have tangible and intangible values. While archaeological sites may contribute to the cultural value of the landscape, they are by no means the major indicator of a cultural landscape. The Wahi Tūpuna chapter does not duplicate the PDP's landscape or heritage provisions, as some submitters have suggested. The New Zealand planning standards require a sites of significance chapter that is distinct from heritage and landscape matters and is better recognised and provided for under RMA Section 6E. The Wahi Tūpuna were mapped by Kaumātua from the Otago Runaka and were confirmed by members of the Southland Runaka. The Wahi Tūpuna contain important values, evidence of use, maybe tapu, sacred, or are the locational context of important traditions or narratives. The Wahi Tūpuna were drawn during large drawn using large topographical maps. The lines were drawn without consideration of cadastral boundaries or planned zoning, but rather based on Komatsu knowledge of ancestral use, occupation, mahi kākai gathering, travel, and cultural traditions. Komatsu descriptions of the QLDC PDP Wahi Tupuna sites and values are based on their knowledge of use and traditions. Much of this information has come from whānau papers, maps, and mahinga kai lists created by Raka Te Rātaka post-European contact. I should say Raka Te Rātaka. There are six areas covered by statutory acknowledgements within the QLDC area: Lakes Hauia, Wānaka, and Whakatipu Wai Māori, Mata O, Closer River, Pikiraka Tahi, Mount Earnslaw, and Tititia, Mount Aswiring. These have been included within the plan as Wahi Tupuna. Potential threats to the sites were considered by Komatsu based on their knowledge of the types of activities that would affect the individual cultural landscapes, considering their histories, associations, and values. The threat activities were aligned with the district plan definitions to ensure council officers and Kārunaka had the same understanding of the threat. On reflection, not enough work went in at this stage pre-notification to narrow potential threat activities. However, concerns expressed by submitters and members of the public at public meetings held after notification has resulted in some refinement of these threats and their geographical application within the Wahi Tupuna. Michael Bathgate will discuss these in his evidence. Applicants undertaking consultation can either seek preliminary direction from Okaha and Te Ao Marama Incorporated before developing their applications or wait until they have a complete application. In both cases, an estimate of costs is provided to the applicant prior to work being undertaken. The entity's consents officers seek guidance from the Rānaka's mandated contact person. Cultural impact assessments are usually undertaken for projects that are complex, may have significant effects, or may affect sensitive sites and values. Costs depend on the complexity of the application. Applicants are invoiced for the actual time taken and expenses relating to site visits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This statement summarises both my pre-circulated evidence and revised position after reviewing other parties' evidence and submissions made at the Chapter 39 Wahi Tupuna hearing. I confirm I've complied with the conduct of preparing the summary and recommended amendments to Chapter 39 and other plan provisions. I support retention of Chapter 39, which recognises and provides for the relationship of Kaitahu with its ancestral lands, waters, sites and taonga, and gives effect to the partially operative RPS and relevant Chapter 3 and Chapter 5 district plan provisions. To aid plan clarity, I recommend amending Objective 39.2.1 and transferring Policy 39.2.1.1, covering district-wide matters, to Chapter 5 Tangata Whenua, so that Chapter 39 focuses solely on management of the identified Wahi Tupuna. I recommend amendments to Policy 39.2.1.2 and a merged version of Policies 39.2.1.3 and 4. I consider these would simplify and clarify the drafting, make the language more consistent with the partially operative RPS and Chapter 3, and give clarity to the policy intent to manage, including avoidance, effects arising from activities on cultural values rather than necessarily the activities themselves. I recommend deletion of policies 39.2.1.6 and 7. It is apparent from submissions that these are causing unnecessary confusion regarding anticipated processes and costs. An amended version of these could be inserted either as methods or advice notes if wording can be found that aids plan user understanding of consultation processes with mana whenua. I continue to support mapping of the three urban Wahi Tupuna, Take Karara, Wānaka, Tahuna in Queenstown, and Te Kirikiri, Frankton, that were notified in Schedule 39.6 and their values described. As stated, the intention is not for Wahi Tupuna-specific rules to apply in these areas or in other areas where the notified mapping overlaps with the urban environment zones. Rather, it is to signify that these areas remain significant to mana whenua, and accordingly, effects on mana whenua values may be relevant in assessing discretionary and non-complying applications in these areas. Further work to develop non-regulatory guidance on discretionary or non-complying activities of greatest interest to Rūnaka in these areas would be advantageous. I recommend changing the column heading in Schedule 39.6 from recognised threats to potential threats. which better recognises that the listed activities do not automatically result in relevant adverse effects that lead to a consenting requirement in Wāhi Tupuna. I have made a number of recommendations in respect of earthwork provisions as follows. While not discussed in submissions and evidence, I recommend an amendment to Rule 25.5.7.2.b concerning roads to exempt urban areas and roading maintenance activities. I recommend a number of changes to the maximum volume standard Rule 25.5.11 in response to submissions and evidence following a discussion with cultural experts. These include fewer exemptions in the Tapu Wāhi Tupuna, as signalled in my pre-circulated evidence, but with newly recommended exemptions for overlaps with the urban environment for minor grading of utilities, except where it involves new support structures, and for indigenous planting. In other Wāhi Tupuna, refining the 10 cubic metre volume threshold to only apply within 20 metres of water bodies at elevations over 400 metres above sea level, except over 600 metres above sea level for Oro, and when modifying a skyline or terrace edge. In addition to those exemptions listed for the Tapu Wāhi Tupuna, for the other Wāhi Tupuna, I've recommended further exemptions in addition to those already provided for in the existing Rule 25.3.2.10 in the Earthworks chapter. These include farming activities raised by submitters that are not already provided for, namely silage pits and drain clearance. With the panel's leave, I'd actually like to slightly revise one of my revised amendments in relation to that, but we can perhaps discuss it when the time comes. I've also suggested an allowance for multiple and separate instances of earthworks up to 10 cubic metres. This endeavours to provide for anticipated activities across a property whilst keeping within a volume limit that will not cause adverse effects in one location. I do not support Ms. Pickard's recommended standard rule 25.5.22, which seems to preclude certain exemptions and makes no allowance for up to 10 cubic metres of earthworks in some locations. I also note that Rule 25.3.2.7 appears to exempt earthworks within a consented building platform in the rural lifestyle and Gibson character zones from the maximum volume rule, something that has come up throughout the hearing. I recommend refining the farm building rule, Rule 39.4.1, so that it only applies to elevations above 400 metres above sea level or 600 metres above sea level for Oro, or where a farm building notifies a skyline or terrace edge when viewed from a public place. I recommend that an allowance be made for replacement or new farm buildings within 30 metres of existing farm buildings. I support Ms. Pickard's amendment to Chapter 30, Energy and Utilities, to provide for small and community-scale distributed generation where attached to an existing building or structure. I note that two submitters at the hearing have asked for provision for ground-mounted solar arrays. I consider this may have merit at a domestic scale, but as there was no evidence on the size or scale of these arrays, and I have had no time to gather such myself, I've made no recommended amendment at this point. In relation to network utilities, after discussion with cultural experts, I've made revised recommendations both to the earthworks and setback from water bodies rules to provide for minor upgrading, except where this involves the addition of new support structures. With regard to the setback from water bodies rule, I recommend deletion of Rule 39.5.1 so that it does not apply to the urban environment. I do not support Ms. Pickard's deletion of structures from the rule. However, I have recommended exemptions to allow for small-scale structures or the minor upgrading of electricity or telecommunications infrastructure, except where this involves new support structures. I support Ms. Pickard's recommended amendment to change water body to wetland, river or lake within these rules, which both provides consistency with other water body setback rules and provides relief to some submitted concerns that were raised through submissions that related to artificial water bodies.
And responding constructively.
was really, which was helpful, so I was going to ask you a lot of that, what she has provided us for. But just wondering how, sort of what the numbers of engagement or consultation looks like now for Okaha, for example, in this district.
Prior to the notification of maps, I think about 10 years ago, we were receiving about 10 consents per year, and it moved towards 15, 20 about 5 years ago, I think. And since the maps were notified and the information was provided to council, we have had a bit of a flurry. So I'm not 100% sure on what the numbers are, but yeah, we have noticed an increase. Maybe another 10 or so since notification, perhaps?
Fair enough.
No, since notification.
So at a rate of 20 per year, figure a year.
Yeah, but I expect them to increase.
Notification was nearly a year ago.
It could have been more. Yeah.
And you've given some examples of what typical costs or costs might look like for a more significant CIA or CBA, but I think in the earlier evidence, or in earlier evidence, there was discussion around the $105 an hour and approximately 3 hours for your average.
Yep. So that example was provided in the public meetings that we had post-notification. So the example came from Dunedin. It was a landlocked section on Mount Cargill, which is the Wahi Tupuna. An applicant wanted to create a driveway or some access. There was a discussion, there was a meeting, and some conditions were agreed, and that cost, they were around the removal of Indigenous vegetation and the replacement of Indigenous vegetation. And there was also some discussion around the specific location of this driveway because of the visual effects it had, and that cost, I think it was $320, and they put that in our earlier evidence.
And they would get a formal response that they would submit?
That's correct. So that person came with their proposal clear in their head. So that was obviously a one-step process. We do have some applicants coming very early in the piece, and basically they get issued a one-pager, which gives them some broad direction about the areas of interest and possible areas of concern, and then that gives them some direction, and then once they've completed their plans or firmed up their proposals, they come back to undertake more extensive consultation.
So, because we've had submitters talking about not only about costs but also about delays, I think we've got a consultancy that's probably got the capacity to deal with a number of applications. I'm wondering if what or how long the turnaround is when you are going back to Runaka, potentially seven Runaka, for a response from them, which is what I understand the process would be. That feeds into your response then to the applicant.
Yeah, so at Okaha we aim for a 6 week turnaround to get that response back to the applicant, and The submitters that did contact us since notification who have spoken to you, I think they all, no one said that we'd gone beyond 6 weeks, so that's, we are meeting those time frame objectives at the moment. We do have staff that we can call on when the numbers get higher. We've got some flexibility to deal with periods of higher consent numbers, so yeah, 6 weeks is our turnaround. But the the applications do go out to Runaka members, many of whom are volunteers. Some of them have mandate to respond on behalf of their Runaka. Others involve a committee, an environmental law and planning committee. So yeah, we do try as hard as we can to get those consents to the Runaka to give them enough time to turn them around.
So I've been passed the baton here, but I'm relatively recently involved in the provisions, so I'll answer it as best I can. I think part of it is to do with the staging of the district plan. The fact that it's very difficult to retrospectively fit those provisions into existing provisions, which are various stages along their planning journey towards being made operative. That's my understanding as well. Also part of it is the prominence that having a separate chapter gives to Wāhi Tupuna, which in and of themselves have a very strong mandate from the higher order planning instruments above them. Probably a feeling that having policies spread throughout the various chapters that may come into play, such as earthworks or subdivision, would sort of lose the prominence of those provisions, if you like. And lastly, I think, as the Commissioner has referenced, the fact that the National Planning Standard is pointing in the direction of having a separate chapter for these types of provisions.
We can probably both speak to this, but I'll
start, I guess. So the main difference, obviously, from an applicant point of view is consenting requirement, the fact that the Queenstown provisions may, in and of themselves, trigger a resource consent, whereas the Dunedin provisions, you're already in a resource consent situation when the Wāhi Tupuna provisions come in as part of the assessment of an activity that will already require resource consent. So that's in a...
Why is that?
Well, I guess from my point of view, having been involved in the Dunedin plan, but not directly in the Wāhi Tupuna provisions, and having come in laterally to the Queenstown plan, I would say bluntly and broadly, bluntly and coarsely perhaps, is the fact that some of the provisions appear quite enabling.
Mm-hmm.
In Queenstown, and I refer in particular to the 1,000 cubic metres for earthworks in an ONL. I think that's probably the most the starkest example of that, where the feeling is that that isn't providing for mana whenua values allowing up to 1,000 cubic metres of earthworks.
That wouldn't be the case. I mean, if you look at a similar sort of
So looking at
Dunedin.
So in Dunedin, by way of comparison, it's 20 cubic metres in an O&L over a 2-year period. There's probably slightly more. There's slightly larger number of exemptions, which I've in my revised recommendations have sort of looked to bring some of those into the provisions. And the other difference in Dunedin is that, speaking of earthworks still, is that there is also that sort of distance separation, so you can undertake more than one activity up to 20 cubic metres on the same site within, it's a 2-year calendar period for Dunedin. It's actually a kilometre separation in Dunedin within an O&L and 400 in the rural zone in general. I've gone for the 400 separation in this instance, but yeah, provides an example of that.
You brought some of the aspects of Dunedin into your most recent series of looking.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
So
yeah.
The Dunedin provisions are stricter, I guess, as a base level, and therefore they've been able to be used, the consent requirements of those have been able to be used as the basis for bringing in an assessment of quite
I believe so. And another example might be subdivision, where there's they're not directly tied to the O&Ls, but there are quite restrictive subdivision rules in the rural environment where you can get to a non-complying activity status if you're above a certain hectareage, if you like, which doesn't seem to be the same case in Queenstown. So that threat is sort of dealt with slightly differently in the two different districts, if you like. The other thing I'd make based on my involvement with the Dunedin plan is that it's come in as, you know, the second generation has come in and been notified as one entity, and it's quite a lot easier, I think, to make those linkages between provisions and providing for Wahitu Puna when you're doing it in one hit like that. Also, the Dunedin plan is an electronic plan, and it's got quite a structured way of linking assessment back through to sort of the policy framework as well. So there's quite a different sort of approach to the connectivity of that, which probably helped both by being a full plan review and being an electronic plan as well. And I don't know that the Queenstown plan, I'm not directly experienced enough in dealing with the Queenstown plan, but I just don't know if it has that ease of accessibility and connectivity between assessments and the various policy suites in the different chapters.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you very much.
Could I just add one thing on that? You know, the size of the sites has received some attention, and we just wanted to note that some of the Dunedin sites are significantly bigger than the Queenstown sites, so the difference of the site sizes is not a significant factor.
Some of the Dunedin sites are bigger.
I think they, you know, I was thinking of Punatapu, and there's a site along the coast, sort of around towards Karatane, where they map basically a very long and extensive number of bays or a large area along the coast. So that would be an example that's quite similar to the Punatapu one.
Values should be the same. In other words, individual for those for that Waihi Tupuna that are of power of relevance.
If I understand the question, and are you referring to 39212 in particular? I think I tried to move the policy language away from threats and particular activities and move them more, and I think this is in line with Chapter 3 in particular and the RPS, more in line to effects on values. So I think that's sort of a...
2212 and your version of it. I mean, I heard you say that you tried to move it towards effects, because that was going to be my next question. But actually, the first line of that chapter says that the following activities may be incompatible with cultural values when listed as a potential threat for an identified fighting to do the area. So my two questions really are, is it that the effects or the activities may have adverse effects
that may
be
incompatible, or the adverse
effects of those
activities may be incompatible, or the effects of it may be incompatible, rather than the
activities themselves.
And
then when you say incompatible with
cultural values held by another federal, do you mean the cultural values identified for a particular Waihi Tupuna by another federal? Okay, yeah. I do, yes. Yeah. And I think it's been, for me anyway, a process, a little bit of a journey with this policy suite, sort of trying to get it in a direction where I'm more comfortable with it. So I also understand the angst that this has caused to some submitters in terms of some of the language in the policy suite and in the schedule. And I don't think it's quite meant to achieve what that language has pointed towards. So in relation to your first question, I think you're right. The following activities may have effects that are incompatible. I think that is the better language. And, you know, that this is part of my suggestion to change potential, you know, from recognised threats, which is quite ominous sort of language.
Yes, like you've done
the next
policy,
that's right. It's quite ominous language for a landowner, if you like. So to change that to potential threats.
Yeah, yes,
that's right. Yep. In relation to your second question, the values, does it refer to the values that are listed in the schedule? No, I don't think it's limited to those. I think that's something that we've probably touched on a little bit with the discussion with the Kaumātua today. I think we've got a little bit of a concern that the values have led to a bit of a reductive approach to the assessment of the Waihi Tupuna and the values within them. They've sort of been identified there to try and give some guidance to plan users for the types of values that may be within each of these Waihi Tupuna, but they're not the whole of the values within the Waihi Tupuna. And I think in and of itself, the Waihi Tupuna is a value, the ancestral relationship with each of these areas is a value, a broad value that sits over each of these in and of itself. So in answer to your question, no, I don't think it's limited to what might be listed in the schedule.
It hasn't come across before to me.
It hasn't, no.
Because, you know, when you look at the schedule and it says values, it doesn't say, well, these might be some of the values, but actually there are lots of others. And I can understand why you're saying that. I'm not saying that that's necessarily an appropriate position.
No, that's right, and I think one thing we might have discussed earlier today, or certainly our team in the break, was whether some sort of advice note around that would be a useful mechanism to... I mean, I think when you heard this, the sort of whakapapa and kaupapa that was passed on from the cultural experts, you get a sense that it's more than just a mahikakai. Yeah, it might have been several mahikakai sites in this Waihi Tupuna. There's a lot more going on in those sort of connections and stories than can be listed in this column in the table.
This is why we were wanting as much as possible.
That's right, and obviously the journey still continues in that regard. So, I mean, whether there can be some sort of advice note put in the plan to sort of signal that.
So what does the RPS thing say? It says, identify the locations on plans of the 182 permit to be protected and the values that contribute to their significance. Mm.
This is in the method.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's sort of pointing, and that's where I was following this track through, is that I understood that that method was pointing to actually quite specific information in the schedule.
Yeah, well, again,
not
I come.
Some of the values there.
Yeah, and I. Sorry.
And that then the policies would follow. Link to those.
To the values, yeah.
In the same way that the court is asking for the landscape values to be identified, the landscape area is now quite understandable.
Asking, I think, is understated.
Telling.
So again, I just come back to my comment, I guess, that I think, and I stand to be corrected, that Mana Whenua value, consider the value of Wahi Te Puna in and of itself an overarching value for each of these areas. And yeah, I guess it raises the question of the degree to which you can integrate this in a column in a schedule is difficult.
Okay, well,
can I follow that up with a similar line of questioning? Because again, when I reread your recommended provisions and the discussion we're having this morning, thinking that the values were, all of the values were contained in the schedule, thinking about it from an applicant's point of view, and I suppose I put to you as a planning expert, if not all the values are specified in that schedule, where does that leave, for example, an applicant who think they've gone ahead, they've looked at all the values, they think they've addressed them all, simply to find they come to, and there are a whole set of other values which are not stated and unknown. What does that do in terms of efficiency, in terms of some, what I'll call sort of credibility of this? Because I thought the idea of stating the values is something which I think is very clear and would give some certainty to the public that we know what we need to be dealing with and how we might avoid those effects or mitigate them. So I suppose the question is, if they're not all in there, doesn't that really undermine the whole basis of efficiency and certainty and trying to establish here a good foundation for what the values are?
Yes, that's a good question. I think I don't know that it entirely undermines it. It certainly would be helpful, obviously, for applicants to have all the information in front of them at this particular point in time. I think this is the really good first start, but it is a bit of a journey, and I think, as you heard the cultural experts sort of reflect on each area, you get a sense that there is still more information coming out of the woodwork, or there's sort of verification processes that may be still in play there, and part of that, my understanding, is relates to sort of resourcing for these types of activities in the past, where you've got a limited number of people trying to capture this information and then make it available for the public. Also, I guess I would just point back at the landscape provisions and the fact that there's not a value. Yeah, value description. I mean, two wrongs don't make a right, I guess.
I understand that, and I understand the context and the landscape of those values might come, so I'll not be poking any real major criticism. I think there's been a major attempt here to identify them. I suppose my question really was how much uncertainty do you introduce when the public think we've got a set of values here, which have been through this process we've talked with Marvel this morning, who have sort of said, yes, we think these are the values and we think we need to look at these, we might need to add some takes away. How much can we wrong, but I'm just really
No. I think you are right. But having said that, I mean, I think a couple of things were picked up as we went through today, questioning why a particular value might not have been listed for a particular Wahutupuna. So I'm not going to sit here and say that I think it's 100% right. I think it's, you know, painted myself into a corner, I don't want to put a percentage figure on it at all. But I think it's really nearly there, and I suspect we may be tasked with going away and doing a little bit more tweaking and with the cultural experts, and I would expect that we get it a heck of a lot closer as a result of that process, and in doing so we'll be able to provide a lot more clarity and certainty to plan users.
Kaumātua in identifying the values that are listed have focused on the values that represented uses of the sites and potentially more tangible values. It's more difficult to capture in a plan the less tangible values, and some of those values may be even more personal, I guess, to people. So Edward was talking about standing on a site and looking at the vista and thinking about what whānau, what the ancestors would have seen from that places, and reflecting on the activities that would have been undertaken there. And I think there's elements of, in the evidence of identity and well-being and transmission of information about tikanga and practices that make up the values within those sites and the reasons for why they are valued today. And it may be really hard to write those into a plan, you could probably have a go, but I don't think that adding those values would provide very helpful information to applicants. I think those intangible values have to be interpreted by the people who are the kaitiaki of these places and have the rangatiranga to define what those values are in these places.
Is that a yes or a no?
What was the question?
Can we implement the RPS and poly?
I think we've had a good go at identifying the more tangible values. I think some of those tangible values have been missed, as has been identified today. I think we could go back and consider how we could add words or descriptors to point to the fact that these values are broader than the particular sites or uses within, you know, that are actually components within the sites. They don't represent the whole site.
I think that also takes us back to your question from the start of the hearing, Mr. Chair, about whether all the components of Wahutupuna as per policy 5.4.5.1 could be mapped. And I think it's a similar slight problem with the language there.
Okay.
policy 39212.
Well, I guess you could simplify it to say that the following activities may have adverse effects on the...
Yes.
Yeah, you could really simplify it down. That's part of the journey of the language. That's right, and I looked at whether the two policies could in fact be combined entirely. Really,
three policies, rather.
Yeah, so really shrinking the set. To my mind, this policy sets up the schedule and the... activities that are listed within the schedule, and then the next one is how you deal with the adverse effects. So I thought, well, it's better to keep them separate. But you're right. I mean, I've sort of crunched it down quite a lot. You could probably crunch it down a little bit further.
It might be useful to have that same language flow from this first policy that
talks
about the...
Yes, and I think if you do... I think if you do really drag it back to that effects language, you probably go some way towards mitigating the fears of plan users that just see, you know, incompatible activities. That's right. Yeah.
Especially if you're starting with subdivision and development, which basically means anything other than status quo.
Yes, well, it's my understanding that subdivision and development is a defined term in the plan and doesn't mean development per se. It's development that relates to the subdivision. You know, driveways and fences and the things that might arise from subdivision. Yeah.
And I noticed that the last two policies you've recommended to Lisa have possibly could be a method or an advice, and I understand why you've done that. I wonder with policy number five, which it's clear and it says what it says.
Yes, I think so, and it probably also relates to Chapter 5, which talks quite a bit about consultation with tangata whenua through the implementation of the district plan, and it just narrows it to the Wāhi Tupuna area and says, and just encourages that process, I guess, of getting in touch with Runaka, with Okaha or Tami to see whether, you know, the level of engagement that might be required over a particular activity. So you're asking whether it's redundant altogether?
No, I'm not saying it's redundant, I'm saying it's a respect. Is it like, because this is a new area that's coming into this plan, for example, it's, you know, an area where people are still gaining an understanding of how to deal with it?
I think that's...
And does that make it more important to have that level of guidance where you might have him about something like residential amenity? I'm not wanting to be disparaging, I'm just trying to use an example.
No, I think that you've answered your own question, I think, to a degree with that, and that it is a relative, I mean, it is a new sort of area within this district. There's probably, and I think part of the journey is also for Manawa Whenua to try and tell these stories, but having said that, there's also a lot of people that have been saying in submissions that, you know, there's no Māori in this district, or three families, or however many that, you know, so it's getting that understanding of what these values are, that they've always, well, not always, but for a long, for centuries, resided in these areas. This is part of the process, I guess. Yeah.
Increasing and extending that level of understanding.
That's right. Yeah.
Making assumptions.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And that's all my question about the policies. Maybe Commissioner Hill, do you have any policy-related
ones? Thank you. I'll pick up. There's probably a little bit of overlap in some of those, but just going right back to the beginning, in terms of your objective, just confirming, I think the discussions we were having with other witnesses about how wide this goes, and I think your rewording. You're clear that this, the way to put this chapter is about the identified items. So we're focusing on those. That's
it is my position. I think there's been quite a bit of confusion with the notified policy set as to how wide it goes. And my recommendation to move policy 39211, you've noted there's no clear objective home for it in chapter 5, so I'm just not quite sure how to proceed on that basis, but I think it sits better.
Well, the legal question as well about whether there's scope to go back to chapter 5. So in terms of that policy, 39211, the one that you recommend in a different form might go to chapter 5. If we decided there was no scope and it should stay here, do you recommend it should stay here in a different form? Because it comes back, and I'll finish off the question, but it goes to the next issue, and the one that Commissioner Dawson raised, which is that term may be incompatible. I mean, the term may is what I think is problematic. But what do you understand by incompatible? Is that a scale issue, or is it an absolute issue? So if those activities are incompatible, it means no.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I think, like the earlier discussion, it comes back to the effects of the activities may be incompatible. And it may be a scale issue, it may be a location, very much a location issue with some of these activities. So the language seems to suggest, the language is slightly problematic, it seems to suggest that they shouldn't occur anywhere in the district, and I don't think that's the intent. The intent is that they, as I say, there may be scale or locational aspects to the effects and how they...
So it's a scale issue, not an absolute issue.
Yes, because none of these activities you could look at and say that they shouldn't occur in the district at all.
And then just in terms of that, can finish off on that policy 3912, where you have said in the header about the potential issues of identified as set out in the schedule. So those are the potential threats. What's listed below, they are the potential threats, aren't they?
Yes.
I'm just wondering what that adds, actually.
I guess
39.6 clearer about what those potential threats are.
I guess the benefit of it is it sets them out in a policy for people to see in one hit rather than having to go through the schedule and, if I'm answering your question rightly, define what all those potential threats are.
Thought in my mind, don't get into a problem that some, I think as Commissioner Smith was identifying, there are some activities that are identified as potential threats in some way to Wayne Tupuna, but not others. Whereas the policy says it implies that there are potential threat everywhere.
Does it? It refers to as set out in schedule 39.6. So
in every way you turn that, if it doesn't mean that, then if you have to go to the schedule to figure out which is a threat where, is the policy more confusing than of assistance?
But that may be something that could be resolved by wording to point you at the schedule to identify where the activities may generate those adverse effects.
I suppose I was quite excited by the idea that the schedule in itself was complete, and therefore, as you said to that policy, you referred to it, as you could refer. hence, I'm sort of coming back from this issue of how do you, if they're to be retained, how do you make it clear so that an applicant, council when it's assessing it, when they come to the room and ask them for advice, it's quite clear what it's all. That's kind of rhetorical because we've got to cover that, but that's where I was going. How do we get some clarity and certainty in these provisions? And as the chair pointed out, I think it was exactly the point, the policy has the threats there, but when you go to the schedule, some apply to some, not to the others, and therefore is that confusing? It's not necessarily a substantive issue, it's how do you make it clear? And hence, the question I was really asking you, I suppose, as a follow-up from Commissioner Dawson, could this policy get rolled into the next two, which you have made clear, avoid significant, and avoid when you mitigate the others?
I guess in theory it could. I don't want to encourage a policy that ends up looking just like the RPS policy. I mean, I guess the benefit of listing these, as I say, is to signal up front that these are the types of potential threats that may exist in Waihitu Puna, and then I guess there's a direction to go and look in the schedule to see which ones apply and which particular.
I understand it, and that's why I thought the schedule was good. In that respect, because it was being quite clear in each way, it was being quite clear what the values were of all the threats. Anyway, that's just my final question on the policy discussion. Is your position, the recommendation that the rules in the, I'll just call them urban for now, in the urban, where the Waihitu Puna overlap the urban, the rules don't apply, but the objectives of policy is void, particularly on discretionary non-complying activity.
I think I made the remark somewhere that there might more work may be advantageous to try and tease out the types of discretionary and non-complying activities that may cause adverse effects on mana whenua values, because looking at some of those zones, there are a lot of discretionary non-complying activities, and some of them are, they range sometimes from some of those that I wouldn't imagine mana whenua would have that much interest, home occupation being an example as a discretionary activity, through to ones where there may well be quite an interest. And the one that springs to mind came in through in I think Mr. Ashton's legal submissions for Remarkable Park, Queenstown Park, querying whether height in the CBD type area sort of seeming to suggest that that wouldn't be a threat to mana whenua values, but my understanding is that very much it could be. But then again, you know, it's sort of scale and location specific as well.
So does it, I'm just trying to revisit how that might happen. So within an urban area, somebody comes and applies for a very tall building, and that's where you might say the values could be adversely affected significantly or something, and you at least might have the opportunity to be able to consider that.
That's right, and I think that's the intention. I think the whole, as you say, the notified thing was a little bit of a red herring. That was probably some clumsy wording from me earlier on when Ms. Pickard took that to think that I was suggesting everything should be notified, every discretionary non-compliant activity in those areas should be notified. No, what I was trying to get at is that it's probably the case from mana whenua perspective, as I understand it, that it's more those activities that are generating a scale of effects that they're likely to be notified anyway, where they want to signal up front to plan users that there are mana whenua values in these areas, and they may want to be part of the discussion.
Thank you.
I think in this instance it does, yes. Notwithstanding the discussions that have been had earlier and the fact that I think it says this in the introduction to the chapter that mana whenua consider the whole district as ancestral landscapes. But I think in this case it does pertain to mapped or possibly scheduled. Well, hey, Tapuna, and that brings us to the discussion of the three.
Yes, I was going to say, my next question is, I had assumed you were drawing a distinction between mapped and identified. So, in case we decided not to map the urban areas, a schedule might be a clearer way to cover that off, irrespective.
Yes, I think so. I guess the Chapter 5 sort of objectives talk about identifying Waiheke Tapuna on the maps. It doesn't necessarily say within a schedule. But yeah, that could be a way of doing it. Perhaps to have some sort of method for where urban areas are identified in the future, that they could be mapped as urban Waiheke Tapuna where relevant, where the sites are, where the values have been identified for those areas, which they have, and then withdrawn in some of these cases for further consideration and further stages of the district plan. But perhaps a method to identify that as a process might be one means of doing it.
Mr. Smith will have a go at the objective policies. I want to keep them separate from the rules. So, yeah, any questions on those?
There's possibly a general question as opposed to.
Well, now's the time.
I'll just follow up on that one first, in that around those urban areas that they've pulled out of the thing. Presumably, we can't just go and put them back in.
You're right.
there's a bit of a consistency problem there, as has been highlighted. Should either all be in or all be out, but we can't put them all in because they weren't there in the first place. And we shouldn't take them all out because there's quite enough urban values that exist over urban areas. So what's the way forward to do a variation?
I don't know the answer, and I suspect it's a location-by-location type question as well.
I think the point is that it should be consistent, so that the location, regardless of the location, the approach to mapped areas of mapped Waiheke Tapuna values should be treated in the same way, regardless, across all urban areas.
Yes, and I think that's the intent, having discussions again with Runaka, I think that is their intent. So I think, is it the Cadrona Valley where there's a potential new settlement zone coming in? I think that would be the intention, that it's treated like other settlement zones for these purposes, like effectively an urban Waiheke Tapuna.
It can't be because it's notified that way.
So So it was notified
in
with
the same state.
Right.
And just like Wanaka and
Queenstown haven't been notified of being active.
Yeah,
Glenorchy has.
Yes.
Probably has in part.
Yeah.
Kingston was, but Mantra is now less so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cadrona is the same.
Kind of not, but
Arrowtown.
Yeah, I mean, there are different areas.
I think in a matter of policy, we can't put wage earner mapping around the withdrawn areas. That's what I think. Now, are we better to map what we can and have a method to map the rest, or are we better to have no maps and say the whole lot should be taken fresh and have a consistent view? There are only three alternatives, and one of them is not open.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what you would suggest of the two of that, but if you think there is another alternative, then tell me.
I mean, for the Waikahawea and Franklin areas, they haven't been withdrawn from the map. We're just never there to start with.
Correct. But the logic of the withdrawal would make it rather odd.
Put some in and take others out.
Yes, exactly.
And even if you could.
Yeah, I'm good.
The underlying presumption is that the values either exist or they don't, and the method of which you deal with them is what is of concern. So, is there either a policy that says ignore the Manapetua value is in urban areas, or do you have one that says that the values exist but they you acknowledge that already developed, so I'm not sure, but
anyway,
we'll
get to
that one.
If I might interject, because it's partly a legal question, just thinking through, if there was scope, ideally you'd map them now, but there is a scope question, I acknowledge it's a difficult hurdle. The alternative is to identify by words in the schedule the areas, but without a map, without them being mapped, and kick off to a variation, the actual mapping later. And then the third approach is a staged approach, because we're necessarily in that difficult waters where we are, council has actually chopped it up into chunks. And so even if there are going to be gaps, for example, at Kingston, that's a function of Council's approach to staging, so we would have to stage their identification. Otherwise, if you don't do it now, you won't be able to do it later when you have the Kingston variation process. Or
authority apply through this stage as well, because there's a settlement zone or something going over the special zone. So.
Okay, I'm not as familiar with detail, sorry, as you are, Commissioner, but anyway, if you don't do it now, there is a risk. It won't happen later for some parts anyway, because it's been staged. So. Thank you.
The second question was around specificity.
That works.
How specific you are. In the Dunedin City Council example that you used, and it's interesting in reading about Gates evidence where you talk specifically around use. And your discussion around use I found quite interesting, because you were talking not in a holistic sense around the landscape, but around a specific corridor of review and the importance of that to that specific value. To what degree is the Dunedin City Council approach more specific across all the values?
I think the Dean ones are quite similar to these, in that some of them are quite activity focused, and some of them are more, as in say earthworks, buildings and structures, that is listed in a very similar way, and then some will also be a little bit more activities affecting ridgelines and upper slopes type things. So there's a little bit of a range there as well, but broadly comparable.
Okay, so in the case of your discussion on views, you sort of leave us hanging. in that you don't make a
I think resetting it would have been, but it's the horse has bolted in that regard, is my view now. Apart from the extent to which some of the rules and provisions attempt to protect those views in a more general sense, but in my evidence, I sort of ruminated, as you say, without reaching a conclusion as to particularly important and highly valued views, and I think the horse has bolted in relation to those.
In regard to the values, though, I touched on this before, that there isn't a point, as I read it, there isn't a specific value identified around views and outlooks in any of the working community areas. There's a range of values, but none of them are specific to the landscape or the outlook. Is that something that is a problem or any policy relating to that?
It just gets me back to my earlier sort of discussion about the connection to the landscape in a broader sense, the relationship of mana whenua with the landscape as a wahi tupuna sort of type of overarching value. Yeah.
So you're just saying that, which I suppose leads us on to the next, question I was going to ask you anyway, is that you talked a bit about have a discussion around whether the values are specific enough, and are they exclusive, like if they're not identified after can those values still be taken into account? We had that discussion around threats as well. Is the list of threats designed to be exhaustive, or is it designed to leave the door open to other threats that might occur? And if the latter is true for both, does let leave too much uncertainty in the system?
I think I've probably answered your question about the values. With regard to the threats, at the time of drawing up the maps and considering the values and threats, I think the Renaka took a practical approach based on threats that were probably envisaged to those particular areas. That's why, you know, some places you don't have buildings and structures, like Tukulaka, for example. The threats read as definitive. Edward, in one of his final comments, said that there probably are additional threats. We would hope that consideration of discretionary and non-complying consents could be brought in to the scope of the wahi tupuna areas that have been identified.
I recall that discussion. You said that in broader activities where they're non-compliant or discretionary, you might consider those. But can we, given that the policies in this chapter relate largely to the identified areas, if there's a non-compliant activity outside this that might have a value that wasn't identified, might be subject to a threat that wasn't identified, is there any support in the policies?
Sorry, were you talking about threat non-defined sitting outside a wahi tupuna?
As I understood it, your suggestion was that if there was an activity that occurred outside of a wahi tupuna area that was not compliant or discretionary, you could consider the broader wahi tupuna values.
That would be one way of looking at it, or you could call it Mana Whenua values across the district. I guess that first policy that I'm suggesting might be shifted to the Tangata Whenua chapter highlights the activities of greatest concern, or what Mana Whenua might have most likely to have input.
In that case, you're relying on the higher order, chapter 3, chapter 5, or sorry, chapter, the earlier chapters, the higher order policies to reach that, or you can also fall down onto the.
They direct to effects, more on an effects basis than an activity basis, I guess, and that's the way it is in terms of not being able to spell out every activity that might be, you know, of concern at any one point in time.
Alright, I'll try and
wrap up.
Can I just ask about
sorry, Commissioner, before I thought I might be able to assist with the answer given in a way. As amended by Mr. Barthcat, he's endeavoured to be very clear that we're limiting policies to the identify wahi tupuna. So I think your hypothetical would not fall within the amended wording, would have to fall within chapters 3 and 5.
That was my suggestion.
Because it's outside, as you said, outside of identify wahi tupuna. So
yeah.
If that's not clear in the drafting, we should make it so. And the conflation problem here is we're very clear on we need to identify the wahi tupuna. That's very clear in the terms of the drafting recommended by Mr. Barthgate. When it comes to the threats and values, a little bit less clear because of the inherent problem of identification of threats and values probably cannot be so definitive, and that's the point Mr. Barthgate made earlier. And then I was just reflecting on, well, certainly we could be far more definitive on values and threats, but or values, as you've heard, but we may not be able to be complete. So that's the issue. And then I was reflecting on what does the RPS actually require, and if you were following the policy framework, was it 222, actually requires identification of the sites, the wahi tupuna. The method goes beyond the policy wording by saying also to identify the values. So there's an interesting point there around if you are focusing on the policy, we must identify the wahi tupuna, but the values, it's not so, quite so clear in that RPS policy that you must do that. It's only when you chunk down the method. So there is an intrinsic problem, though, around identifying all values now, because there is a scope for those to evolve over time, I think is our point we're making. So I hope that's useful.
I was just thinking, if there's no scope to move policy 39211 to chapter 5, say the result, and there's no other home for it, and chapter 39 becomes a policy, a chapter about wahi tupuna sites, you wouldn't really want to lose that policy 1 as it related to wahi tupuna sites, because it expresses activities which may well have
agreed, and when I was sort of earlier on in the process wondering how this policy got there, that was my summation, I guess, that this, you know, these activities are incompatible throughout the district, but they'll be particularly incompatible within wahi tupuna. So as a plan B, keeping them in here applied to wahi tupuna would be the second best result.
Of the structure.
structures that they're in, like, have, and the fact that they're volunteers, and the fact that some of them consult with the broader committee on the consents, and it also allows for the fact that at any one time the Rūnaka may have multiple consents from multiple councils, let alone often the same people are dealing with these sorts of processes, plan changes, mapping. They are involved in many, many things across the board. 6 weeks we hope would be the maximum amount of time, but that's the indication that we give to applicants to give them some assurance that it's not going to take considerably longer.
I think it just reinforces the need to consult or engage pre-lodgement if we can.
And just one other question, which the Chair sort of directed me towards you guys on, was the one around financial conflicts of interest and green light party tourism activities. And in the case of a conflicting, the Dark River jet boat was the example that we had. If there was a conflicting, an operator who wanted to start up an operation on the river of some sort, would there deem to be a financial conflict of interest, and how could you resolve that in this process?
So you'll know that the Rūnaka don't have any scope to comment on trade competition matters. The Aukaha and Te Ao Marama are separate standalone entities. There's no connection with Ngāi Tahu Holdings or the entities that sit beneath that. The Rūnaka have explained with regard to the DART, the really significant cultural values up there, and also their interests with regard to the commercial and commercial recreational activities. So they were mainly around waste and the appropriateness of activities occurring, particularly around the tapu sites, and the cumulative effects, I guess, of around overcrowding and effects on the natural environment and so forth. So I don't consider that to be a concern in any way.
Just reflecting on the comments that were made today, they refer to our operation. So clearly they have a sense that it is part of them and part of their activities.
I think there's a lot of pride in the fact that those operators are telling the stories correctly of the place, and that's another one of the areas of focus when it came to those commercial and recreational activities, that their stories were being told correctly and being honoured. So I think there's definitely, a spiritual or philosophical connection, but there's no direct connection between those entities.
Without understanding the specifics of the financial situations, is there a risk that some of the parties who might be assessing have a financial interest in
Sorry, I was just going to miss this because it is a prohibited ground, as you'll be aware, to raise as a relevant matter trade competition laws. It's section 308B RMA for resource consents, and I think clause 6 of the first schedule. So there's a bright line. But what it does say, interestingly, is that if you could gain an advantage in trade competition, your submission basically must be limited to matters where there's an adverse effect to the environment and not relate to the effect to trade competition or the effect of trade competition. So there's a bright line. You might still be able to make a submission, but the province, the scope of that would be limited to basically relevant effects in the environment.
But does that apply to effective party approvals, where it's just a go or no-go as opposed to a submission?
So it's an interesting question. I mean, basically, with affected party approvals, normally you'd have a discussion with the applicant around that, and sometimes you'll come to a site agreement which may well cover a range of things that wouldn't normally find their way into a submission. But if you're making a submission, your submission would obviously have to be limited by the no trade competition rule. So if there's not an agreed position reached, then you're very much limited by those bright line tests.
Thank you. I'll leave it there.
think there was a subtle difference, and I certainly hope that it wouldn't be not giving effect to the RPS and having slightly different language. The language I have more reflects the language in strategic directions, chapter and policies 33, 33 and 34. This is an interesting one. I think the RPS, when it looks at sort of highly valued resources, takes this New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement framework of, you know, the significant, avoiding significant effects on the values that contribute to significance of something being an outstanding natural coastal character or an outstanding natural landscape. And the processes that go to identifying those areas often do involve, say, the Pigeon Bay criteria and ranking values high, medium, high, et cetera, et cetera, through a sort of a similar identification and assessment process that's maybe considered slightly different to the process that we've heard about today in terms of identifying Wāhi Tūpuna. I don't know that you can, at that values level, rank significance in the same way the cultural experts might have to answer to that. With the possible exception of tapu areas, and in that same way. So where I'm getting at, I guess, with this is that I think it is more about the significance of the adverse effects in a more general sense than any particular effects that contribute specifically to Wāhi Tūpuna being significant. I have considered that, and I did notice that overlap in site size between those two particular zones. The rural residential one is in particular is the one where there might be construed as a bit of overlap. The rural lifestyle, I think, is 1 hectare, which is, you know, arguably, or even 2 years, or which is, you could contend, more clearly within a rural spectrum. So I did consider it and discuss it with the cultural experts too in relation to where those zones sit. I think the overlaps are at Puna Tapu, obviously. That's right. And so the discussions there were about it being, you know, the tapu nature of that Wāhi Tūpuna, and I think it's probably part of the homework is going away and having another look at that. But yes, yeah, so I did consider that. And I guess it's an easy way to follow through the plan structure and say urban environment here and rural environment there, but I can see that there is, you know, quite an overlap between the rural res in particular and some of those lower density residential zones.
Your 400 meter above sea level recommendation, and
Yes, I have. After the evidence was lodged by the submitters, we went through an exercise with the Komatua of looking at those areas. They tend to be around Hawea, as raised through submissions, where around the Whakatipu, it's a little bit more clear cut, but yeah, around Hawea, it tended to be around that 400, did cut across some sort of farm curtilage type areas. So we looked at them, and but also looked at sort of surrounding areas as well, where it was just considered that effects on values between 400 and 500 may be give rise to adverse effects. And so I guess the way I've tried to deal with it is by bringing in a sort of greater range of exemptions, through earthworks, farm buildings,
proximity
in terms of farm buildings, etc. So it's not, I mean, no line like that obviously is going to be a perfect planning tool. And so, you know, I concede that for those submitters that is of concern, and I've tried to address it through different mechanisms.
One clarification for me, please. Page 12 of your latest report, this is the exceptions to the structural rule, and it's the structure of the maximum height no greater than 2 metres and maximum 5 metres. Is that in relation to Aurora's? Is that what you were intending here? Or is it, I mean, I know it will apply wider, but is that where that's come from?
It's come from a combination of there and also the definitions of buildings and structures, where that's exempted from being considered as a building. Just gave a bit of a guideline for scale, but also it does tie in with the Aurora's submission.
Thank you.
I think you had an amendment.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just the reference I made earlier to a revision of my revisions when I read through my summary statement. And I'm sorry, I'm not intending to cut off any further questioning, but was in relation to the earthworks rules and the sort of, so we look at page 7, exempting from my proposed rule 25.11.2, earthworks is part of farming activity for the digging of silage pits or the clearance of drains. I think going back to 25.5.11.2 proposed, I think the intention I have here is that it doesn't apply within 20 metres of the bed of a river, lake, etc., particularly in relation to silage pits. Drains, you could probably make an argument either way that they may be well be within these environments. And then clause G as well, I'm a little bit on the fence about the separation and whether that should apply within the that riparian river lake wetland margin in particular. I guess the one I have most concern about is silage pits not wanting to be seen to be encouraging those within those setbacks.
That's
right. Yeah, so my councillor is just helping me out here a little bit. So like an example wording might be in clause F, the following are exempt from rule
same 10 metres cubed apply to that, or is the answer, is there a zero trigger?
No, the intention was that the 10 cubes applies there, and I acknowledge there's a slight disconnect with Earthworks Chapter rules, which I think it's a five within 10 metre requirement. So, but no, the intention is that the 10 cubes applies in there. I'm open to suggestions. I realise this is a sort of complex proposition, but I would have thought that it would be a fairly nearby public place would be the intent. I would have thought that a fairly nearby, I mean, that's not very good planning, rule drafting, is it? But a reasonable, yeah, within reasonable proximity was the intent there. As you probably realise from my evidence, I'm sort of cobbling this from an existing rule in the rural chapter. And I think, again, with the marvellous benefit of hindsight, having mapped, which I understand occurs in some parts of the Waikato Basin, having mapped escarpments and terrace edges would be a preferable way to do this, but yeah.
Yes, I'm just thinking that the larger the radius, the greater the enforcement issues and the cost to proponents. So if you could say within 400 metres, for instance.
That's right, and 10 cubic metres. I mean, I think we had Mr. Devlin's evidence with his picture of a skip or some packaging boxes to represent 10 cubic metres, which on the surface don't look very large. My counter to that was if you had 100 of those skips, you know, at 1,000 cubic metres, it is very significant. But here we're dealing with the 10 cubic metres, and I take the point that distance would mitigate that.
So
the effect of that.
Nearby.
That's right.
I answer that in two parts. I saw there were four topics basically: the scope, the mapping and descriptors, and so the script is in table 39.6, and then there's a whole bunch of mapping issues. A table of amended reliefs, so Mr. Bathgate would put forward a slightly modified version reflecting the Q&A today, and I did want to just address.
No, I'm not talking about all the answers.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, I think there's only 4 points on the list.
As you say, within there is a whole, there are numerous, I think, sub elements in the schedule.
Yes.
So if you could give us your list.
Sure. Yes, that's fine. I just wanted to test out that I was not off beam, but. And the fourth point was I was going to just address two cases on the this methodology of looking back through the eyes of your ancestor is a legitimate means of identifying cultural landscapes, and there's some case law, particularly Matakana, about what's called the fourth dimension. So I just thought it might be useful for you to have a look at that. So those are my four headings, but I can put that in a memorandum and seek leave.
So if you could file that by, say, 1 p.m. on Friday, we will confer and be back to you. Most of us are gathering in Queenstown next Tuesday, so I assume you will get an answer early the following week. And I was thinking that, I'm just looking at my calendar now, it's the 7th of August, too soon. That would be, assuming that's the best part of 2 weeks thereafter.
So, again, to answer that in two parts, I think for some of it, not that would be fine, but it's the mapping and where the Kaumatua inputs are required, we might seek a bit more time. I had previously spoken.
Maybe our final day of hearing is going to be the 14th. It can't be go beyond then, because then we start pushing the council's reply out,
sure.
Which is going to create a problem. Can I suggest then that when you file your memorandum with your list, give me a date that you can commit to having consulted with people you need to consult with about who will be providing inputs, on the basis that the date has to be it's actually the 13th of August is our last day. You can file your list, assuming you'll get an answer.
Sure, thank you.
So on that note, I'll adjourn on this slide. Estimate of a day was pretty accurate. So we're adjourned until Tuesday, the 28th of July, back in this venue, but without